But you will receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you. And you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, in all Judea and Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. Listen to this, my friends. This is just absolutely nuts. Bonkers, as my 7-year-old son would say. This is bonkers. According to the estimates of historians, by the end of the year 100 CE, there are fewer than 10,000 Christians in the entire Roman Empire. Followers of Jesus only made up 0.01% of the entire population. By the year 200, though, the number of Christians had increased to somewhere around 200,000. So 10,000 to 200,000 in 100 years' time. Like, even though the church only still made up a tiny little portion of the overall population, we should note that over the course of just 100 years, the church grew 20 times larger. Like, can you imagine the church growing somewhere around 20 times larger in your lifetime? Like, if St. Paul's grew 20 times larger, we'd have somewhere around 900 people coming every single Sunday. But that's not all. Staggeringly, between the years 200 and 250, the number of Christians rose from 200,000 to over 1 million. In other words, in just 50 years, the church went from having 200,000 people in it to over 1 million people. But then, and get this, this is just absolutely nuts. By the year 300, only another 50 years later, the number of Christians in the empire is estimated to have skyrocketed from 1 million to 6 million in just 50 years. Crazy. Now, here's the really crazy thing, as if the numbers in and of themselves aren't crazy enough. All of this growth happened before the year 300 CE. But the Nicene Creed wasn't finalized until the year 325. So this dynamic growth happened before there was a universally agreed upon dogma in the church. All of this growth happened before the year 300 CE, but the books of the New Testament weren't canonized until the year 382, meaning that all of the growth occurred before there was such a thing as the official New Testament, even. Furthermore, and get this, persecution against Christianity didn't stop in the East until the year 311, and it didn't stop in the West until 313. I might actually have those mixed around. Well, around 312 was when persecution stopped all across the empire. So in other words, all of this explosive growth happened during seasons and periods of intense persecution, violence, and suffering, right? Now, I've heard some people naively argue that Christianity didn't really take root and it didn't really grow until it became the official religion of the Roman Empire under Constantine's influence, right, and decisions. No. All of the growth that we're talking about today happened not just before Christianity had become the official religion, but all of this growth happened while it was still being oppressed by the empire even. Now, here's the million-dollar question. How? How did it happen? How did this one-time, fledgling little movement, composed of Hebrew fishermen, prostitutes, tax collectors, the poorest of the poor, heretics, sinners, and some Marys and Marthas, how did this little movement go on to win the hearts of 6 million people in just 300 years' time? And let's not forget, my friends, that the original leader of this movement, Jesus, he was crucified by those in power because they were once threatened by his movement. Let's also not forget that all of this growth happened despite the fact that most of the earliest leaders in the church were also brutally executed by the Roman Empire or by other authorities, right? I mean, think about it. Stephen was stoned to death. Paul was beheaded. Peter was crucified upside down. Got early bishops and priests like Polycarp. He was burned at the stake and then stabbed for good measure as if the burning wasn't enough, right? Ignatius of Antioch, he was mauled by lions. And that's just to name a few of the early martyrs. So let's get this straight. The early Christians had no official dogma that united them at that time. They had no official New Testament. On the best days, they were not protected by the empire. On the worst days, they were actively persecuted by the empire. And most of the leaders of this movement, they were murdered in very gruesome and public ways. And yet, the early church didn't just survive. History tells us the church thrived. It thrived. Now, is it just me, or do we today perhaps have something to learn from these earliest Christians, especially since we're living in an age of rapid church decline? Like, perhaps they put their finger onto something, some innate human need, some shared collective impulse that the modern church has all but lost sight of. Could it be that these ancient Christians, even though they lacked all sorts of things, could it be that they actually did not lack the one thing that really matters, but we are missing so much in our church today? The answer, as we're going to see both this week and next week, is yes. Yes, they did very much have something that we today are lacking. Lacking, maybe that's not the best term. In my personal opinion, it is, but, you know, if you don't like the word lacking, at the very least, it's something, they had something that we don't have enough of today. There was something that was so central to these earliest Christians that we've pushed to the margins, and only a few of us Christians are actually talking about it. To put it bluntly, the earliest church, they had a common spirituality that many people back then and so many people today still long for, hunger for, yearn for. The short way of saying it, they had a common practice of meditation. Meditation, yes, meditation was woven into the very fabric of the church's existence. To be a Christian was to be a contemplative. As we're going to see next week, Jesus was a contemplative. He was a mystic, and he passed on a particular method of prayer, of meditation, to his followers. And my friends, this meditation method, this meditation practice was so central to the early church's identity and way of life, so much so that if like St. Paul or St. Peter or St. Ignatius of Antioch, you name any number of them, if they could stroll in to any number of American churches today, they simply would not recognize the meditationless religion that now passes as Christianity today. These saints would see a Christianity, a church, that's only a shell of its former self. Now here's the thing. The earliest Christians learned meditation before they even had a formalized creed. The earliest Christians learned meditation before they even had a finalized New Testament. Most did not have buildings, but they had meditation. In other words, the practice of meditation or contemplative prayer or habitual recollection, whatever you want to name it as, it was more central to the faith for them than the written New Testament or the Creed or any building. And it was their collective spirituality that was the main ingredient, the main thing that triggered all of the explosive growth that we were just talking about. And if you don't believe me, fine, fine. But you can take it up with saints like Saint Athanasius. That's all over the writings of the saints. Listen to what Saint Athanasius had to say about Saint Anthony the Great. Anthony the Great, one of the early desert fathers. Just a little background. Anthony lived during the most dynamic era of the early church's growth. But Anthony was not a preacher. He wasn't a missionary. He wasn't trying to proselyze people into the faith. He wasn't actually trying to grow the church. That wasn't what he was about. He was just a simple monk who lived a good chunk of his life alone in the solitude of the desert. But listen, listen to how Athanasius describes Anthony's impact. He said that Anthony's fame had been blazoned everywhere, and all sorts of people regarded him with awe and wonder. Even people who had never met him before longed to meet him after hearing about him. Athanasius writes, everywhere from Spain to Gaul, from Rome to Africa, people are talking about this man who lives hidden away in a desert mountain. And Athanasius specifically says that it wasn't Anthony's writings or his wisdom or his talent that made him so famous. It wasn't like he was a great teacher or a charismatic leader or preacher or anything. No, it was exclusively Anthony's, quote, piety towards God that drew the masses to him. In other words, God drew the whole world to Anthony because his life emanated healing and wholeness. because Anthony embodied the divine presence in such a way where people could actually feel it. In Anthony, people saw someone who had figured out, I don't know, how to be human, right? Balanced, grown up, mature, centered, right? In other words, he had a real Dalai Lama, Desmond Tutu vibe going for him. Another way of putting it was the fruit of Anthony's contemplative, meditative way of life that attracted the world to him like a magnet. People saw and heard about Anthony's attributes, like his peaceful demeanor, his centered way of life, and his exuberant joy. Even this guy who's been living in the desert in a mountain by himself was so joyful when people encountered him. And they realized that the things that he had been cultivating within himself, those were the types of things that they were lacking in their own hearts. Athanasius concluded his biography on Anthony by saying that this sort of thing, it's not at all unique to Anthony, though. Even if you don't become a desert monk, everyone who pursues a similar path in life, a contemplative, meditative path in life, they will eventually have a similar magnetic impact on the world around them. I mean, think about this. All Anthony wanted to do was to flee from the world and to go into the desert so he can meditate in peace by himself. But the world chased him into the desert just so it could sit at his feet and learn from his ways. For Athanasius, and this is key, it's clear that Anthony's story is not just Anthony's story. Athanasius was using Anthony's life as a metaphor for the church at that time. In the same way that Anthony had drawn the whole world to himself through his contemplative way of life, the church at that time had drawn the whole world to herself through her contemplative way of life. And there's no mystery as to what they were actually doing, people like Anthony. There was a method that was spelled out very black and white for us. Thanks to the writings of another saint, Saint John Cassian, we actually know the exact method of meditation that Anthony and others around him were practicing and teaching to others. You see, not too long after Anthony died, John Cassian went on a pilgrimage into the desert to learn how to pray. And at one point on his journey, a monk named Abba Isaac, or Father Isaac, someone who actually knew Anthony and referred to Anthony as Blessed Anthony, he told John Cassian about a prayer formula that all of the desert monks had been using for a long time, and they'd been teaching this formula to all of those who'd come to them on pilgrimage, or if they were going out into the cities to teach and preach, right? And the reason they taught this specific formula, they said, was because it was simple and it was accessible to everyone. Regardless of your background, regardless of whether you could read or write, regardless of your spiritual maturity or lack thereof, everyone could practice this prayer method and discover their union with the divine. And this prayer formula was a mantra. And Saint Isaac says that it was actually Saint Isaac, I guess he's a saint, Abba Isaac, said that it was handed down to the desert monks by the oldest monks in the community. And those oldest monks, in turn, they would have received it from those who came before them, right? Now, as we're going to see next week, this general meditation method, it goes all the way back to Christ himself. But the specific mantra that these particular monks were using, it goes back to at least 250 CE, at least, probably even earlier. Now, remind me, my friends, what was happening around the year 250 CE? Oh yeah, 5 million people were converting to the faith. That's what was happening. So during the era of the early church's most explosive growth, Cassian tells us that lots of Christians were praying a specific prayer mantra. And it was simple. The mantra was this: "Come to my help, O God. Lord, hurry to my rescue." It's the opening line of Psalm 70. Most of us here should be very familiar with this line, this psalm line, because it's also the opening line of our evening prayer service. O God, make speed to save us. O Lord, make haste to help us. Abba Isaac even gave specific instructions on how everyone was praying this at the time, or seeking to pray it at least. He writes, "The thought of this mantra should be turning unceasingly in your heart. Never cease to recite it in whatever task or service or journey you find yourself on. Think upon it as you sleep, as you eat, as you submit to the most basic demands of nature. This heartfelt thought will prove to be a formula of salvation for you. In other words, recite this mantra, and not only will it be a divine therapy to you, but through this mantra, God will empower you to become a healing presence to everyone around you. O God, make speed to save us. O Lord, make haste to help us. My friends, more than anything, early Christianity was a profound spiritual, wide-scale awakening. It was a contemplative awakening. It was nothing less than an outpouring of the Holy Spirit. If you and I desire to see something similar happening in our churches, in our towns, in our cities, in our lifetime, we must do what the ancient Christians did. We must go back to our roots. We must reclaim the center, right? We must ready ourselves, ready our hearts for the movement of the Spirit. We must awaken our slumbering minds to our union with the divine. We must use a mantra to knock on the door until the door is opened to us. And the earliest Christians have shown us the way through the practice of meditation. Whether you choose their specific mantra or another formula, it doesn't really matter. As long as you get to a place in your prayers where you are doing more listening to God than more talking at God, right? But if we do this, we commit to this contemplative spirituality. If we meditate, not only can we become the type of change that we want to see in the world, but we will become the type of change that others want to see in the world as well.